Self-evidently, I'm not a theologian and I'm not an historian. As Stephen said, I'm a GP, and GPs are sort of jack of all trades. And I think that is a fairly accurate description of me. You know, I can turn my hand to lots of different things, but I'm not really an expert at any of them. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk a little bit about my experience over the past 10 years. I joined the PUP in 2000. I joined it to support David Irvine, who I thought was refreshingly honest, progressive, thoughtful, self-critical. And I thought that's the sort of man that Northern Ireland needs more of. So I joined it to support him. And as they say, one thing led to another. And culminating, I suppose, last year in finding myself as the interim leader of the party. And I have to say, I joined with no political aspirations at all. So I suppose you never quite know what one action will lead to ultimately. But it's been a fascinating past 10 years from a personal point of view. And of course, from a national point of view, it's been an absolutely riveting 20 years. We're now almost 18 years from the ceasefires. The conflict has had a rather long tail. We still have the dissidents and we still have loyalist paramilitary organisations, but we have seen a momentous political process. We've got political structures up and running. We're not quite sure yet how effectively they serve the community or how adequately they're held to account, but we certainly have them in place. They're evolving. We have a civic society that's becoming increasingly engaged with the political institutions, increasingly robust and active. But we do have still, we're left with very significant social and economic problems in the country. We find ourselves at a time of economic crisis, but even before that developed, we had a legacy from the past, but we had a significant, some would say growing, I'm not sure if I entirely agree with that, but we have significant social and economic problems. And I suppose the question that poses is, what can the church do in this situation? And what obstacles does it face to making a significant impact on these social and economic problems that we face? Many of these issues are seen, I suppose, most clearly in loyalist communities. Not by any means exclusively. But if you want to see some of them in stark relief, go to some of the loyalist areas and you'll see them there. But maybe we should start with a definition. You know, let me address the question, how do loyalists view themselves, and start by defining, well, what is a loyalist? And if you were to ask 10 people, you probably would get 10 slightly different answers, but there would be significant overlap between them. And for the purposes of tonight, I'm going to call loyalists working class unionists. Unionists, stroke, Protestant, from the more socially and economically disadvantaged areas. They would view themselves as working class. Some of them would consider being aligned to a paramilitary organisation as part of loyalism. Some of them, and a minority, some of them would consider a loyalist as someone who's prepared to take up arms to defend their community. And it perhaps needs to be said that there is a still smaller minority who would say today that arms would still be justified to achieving political ends. But they would be a very small minority. But some would say, and this reflects their history, that taking up arms is justified to defend your community. And that's how they interpret the events of the past 40 years from a loyalist perspective. Loyalist communities, I find quite striking is how pessimistic many loyalist communities are. There's a certain fatalism. There's a negativism there. They are discontent, dissatisfied, unhappy. Many of them are. And very negative about everything. They are, and not surprisingly, they are also pretty negative about themselves. One woman said to me, and I quote her exactly, said, "But sure, we're crap." And that was her assessment of herself and her community. There's a genuine lack of confidence. One of the first things that Don Purvis said to me is, our communities need to gain confidence. They lack confidence. With that, there's a lack of aspiration. Why is there a lack of aspiration? Because many people don't believe that their life will ever become any better, or that they're capable of making their life any better. There's a significant amount of mental ill health, depression. Belfast has the unenviable notoriety of having the highest prescription of antidepressants of any comparable city in Western Europe. So there's a significant amount of mental ill health, and there is a significant amount of self-hatred. And people don't talk in terms of self-hatred, but it's expressed in antisocial behaviour, particularly among males, in educational dropouts, in self-harm, again among young women. So there is a very, very negative self-image. It's perhaps not altogether surprising when we look at the media portrayal of loyalists. If I were to say to you, who is the archetypal loyalist? What name springs to mind? Okay, well, we've probably got several. Okay, I think for many people, Johnny Adair represents a loyalist. And it's that caricature of a muscled, permatanned, tattooed, gold necklaced, numerous ringed male with a pit bull terrier and a tight t-shirt. We can laugh, but that's how loyalists have been portrayed for years and years and years. As thugs, you know, knuckles dragging along the road as they walk. Bigots. They say that in Longkesh, while the Republican prisoners took university courses, the loyalist prisoners went down to the gym. Well, in actual fact, more loyalist prisoners left Longkesh with university degrees than Republican prisoners did. And I know at least one who came out with the first class honours. So there has been a portrayal of loyalism that is pervasive and has been very effective in painting a picture of what loyalists look like. Now, that's not to say that some are not like that, but it is a caricature. And it's a stereotype. It does a disservice to a whole section of our community. And of course, if you tell people often enough this, that's what they are, then that's what they'll come to believe. If you tell them that they're stupid, and that they're ignorant, and that they're hopeless, and that they're useless, then a certain amount of that will stick, and they'll come to believe that's exactly what they are. It's true, in my opinion, it's true to say that within loyalism there's a certain paranoia. They believe that they've been criminalised. They believe that they've been treated unfairly. They believe that nobody is prepared to stand up for them. And really, in fact, contemporary events to some degree support that perception. I mean, let me give you two examples. The historical inquiries team. Now, there are no votes to be won by criticising the historical inquiries team. But within loyalist communities, they were continually saying, how come the HET is focusing on loyalists? This is unfair. And they asked for information from the HET as to figures and statistics and what was going on. And in loyalist communities, all they heard was about people being lifted and taken in for questioning. And then the Irish News put in a Freedom of Information request to find out what were the statistics of arrests made by the HET. And this was before the last election. And the statistics that came out were that there were 95 arrests had been made, of which 92 were loyalists and 3 were dissident IRA. Now things have changed since then, and the HET is pursuing Republican crimes and etc. But that was how it started off, and you can see how that feeds a certain paranoia. I'll give you another example. The Progressive Unionist Party in the last election launched our manifesto. It was a low-key event on the shoestring, but it actually got a surprise. Well, I shouldn't say surprising. It got, in from many quarters, got a very positive response. A number of journalists said, "It's nice to get a manifesto with some fresh ideas, some original thinking in it." Well, when the Belfast Telegraph did its report on it, there was a page, the better part of 2 pages, the Belfast Telegraph, of which 2/3 of 1 page was a masked gunman, and the rest was writing about the manifesto. Now, I ask you, is that stereotyping or not? And so that is what loyalist communities perceive as happening to them. And that's why they react negatively to media and to many people who come to them. Okay, now, I don't want to get into exaggeration now and over and undermine my point by over-exaggerating it or by exaggerating it. But just to say that the media portrayal of loyalists, I think, has been lazy and stereotypical and inaccurate, and it has produced a certain paranoia within loyalism. How do loyalists view the church? Well, for many years, they viewed it at best irrelevant. They experienced it as being judgmental, disinterested, and more concerned with proselytizing and making gaining members than being genuinely interested. Now, I have to say that has changed, and has changed very significantly. Most loyalists, the majority, would not have any church involvement and would still be critical of the institutional church, but they have an enormous respect for many Christians who have worked with them and become engaged with them, and who have acted as mediators, as critical friends, who have worked in the community, and who have really ended up being of very significant assistance to loyalist groupings. And in some cases, we're way ahead of secular society in terms of connecting and listening to loyalist communities. Let me give you another example. In East Belfast, there is two excellent community development organisations. There's a Walkway Community Centre on Finvoy Street off the Lower Newton Arch, off the Newton Arch Road, or in fact it's at the very bottom of the Upper Newton Arch Road, and there's Bloomfield Community Association, and Bloomfield Presbyterian Church went to them and said, "What can we do to help?" And they entered into discussions, and Bloomfield Presbyterian ended up, Walkway wanted to have an after schools club, and so Bloomfield said, "Okay, that's great. Have you got a premises?" They said, "Yes, we're going to use that terrace house just opposite the community centre." So Walkway refurbished the whole house, and then provided former teachers to come in and work with the kids in the after schools club, and it had a significant impact on the people in the Walkway Community Centre. Now, the folks there would not profess to be Christians as we understand, as in the evangelical sense of being Christian, but they've got a superb relationship with the folks from Bloomfield Presbyterian Church, and that has been a very positive and fruitful relationship. that has benefited the whole community there. And Walkway Community Association is a brilliant community association. It does fantastic work off Ravenscroft Avenue and down around the Hollywood Arches. And it's been made more effective by the contribution of Bloomfield Presbyterian. What are the problems then that beset loyalist communities? Well, I've picked out my top four in the manner of all modern TV programmes. What are the top 10? This and that. I've got my top four problems for loyalist communities. My first is unemployment. Now, I know that employment is an issue. I mean, I've got a number of kids who've left university in the past year or two, and I'm fully aware of the difficulties of graduate employment, but believe me, the problems of unemployment in the loyalist communities is much greater than that. And there really has been the whole structure of vocational training was dismantled in the 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. And it got to the point where in the 90s you could go to Belfast Met to train as a plasterer or to train as an electrician, but when it came to a bit about work experience, the people or the student themselves, they had to arrange their work employment. Now, if your dad is a spark, that's pretty straightforward. If you're from a single parent family, your mother's struggling to keep you up and is doing two cleaning jobs in order to put you through school or college, you've no chance of at least you very again here I'm exaggerating again. Your chances of getting work employment are poor, sometimes extremely poor. So there is a real problem where kids leave school and there's nowhere to go. There's no career track. There's no elevator where they get on at the bottom and then get up to next level and up to next level. Mm-hmm. In those communities, it's largely absent. It would be wrong to say it's totally non-existent, but it's largely absent. Second problem is educational failure. Now, Dawn Purvis, in her report, has really, I think, done a terrific job in just highlighting the issues. And there's lack of aspiration, lack of parental involvement, lack of experience in terms of reading and writing. There's a whole mishmash of factors that contribute to the fact that really, I think one of Dawn's figures was that 73% of kids from the Lower Newton Arch Road leave school without five GCSEs. That's only 27% mm-hmm. come out with five GCSEs of a C or higher. I won't labour it because we're all aware of it. But again, it feeds into the unemployment, and we still are that I think that is the key issue that we need to be addressing. The third problem is ill health, and particularly mental health, addiction, depression, alcoholism, and this of course then leads anyway to being unfit for work, family breakdown, further poverty. So there is a significant problem with drugs, alcohol, depression, mental health. In loyalist communities, and it's the old chicken and egg situation, really, isn't it? With family breakdown and poverty and depression, etc. And then my fourth problem is persistence of paramilitary organisations. And you might ask me, how come 18 years after the ceasefire and what is it? Nearly 12 years after the Good Friday Agreement, why do we still have loyalist paramilitary organisations? And that's a very good question. But the fact of the matter is that we do. And let me give you six reasons why they're still there. The first is because of the dissident IRA. And they see themselves as defenders of their community, and they believe, and with some justification, that if they hadn't been around in the 70s, then some of their communities would have been decimated, and they saw themselves as being the defenders of their community, and they don't believe that as yet the threat has entirely gone. And certainly if a bomb was to go off on the Shankar Road or in Consulator Shopping Centre, it would, I think, shake things up a bit. So that's one reason why they're still there. The second reason why they're still there is that paramilitary organisations are very conservative, suspicious, distrusting, and they move very slowly. They don't embrace change. They're not rapid adapters. They are often have a very conservative mindset. A third reason is that paramilitary organisations give young men significance, kudos, importance. Furthermore, they give young men identity, a peer group to belong to, and a route to power. And more so in the past than today, but in the past it was a route to riches. And finally, two more reasons why they're still there. One is because there's criminality. And it's, in my view, it's a minority, but there are some paramilitaries who still are making a very nice living, thank you, from criminality, and that is one reason why they haven't, another reason why they haven't gone away. And then finally, I think they're still there because of, in my view, a misplaced loyalty. They are loyal to their organisation. And, I mean, loyalty is a virtue. And they are loyal to the men that they stood with and that they served time in Lonkesh with and that, they, that they've met with and talked to. But that, that does not imply that the organisation needs to go on, but there is a certain loyalty, a significant loyalty among many of them to the organisation. So let me move on then and sort of draw my contribution to a close and open it up for some discussion of the contributions. What are the obstacles which the church faces in helping loyalist communities? And the first one is that we do need to be careful. It is very easy to appear patronising, and folks in disadvantaged communities are not stupid. They may be impoverished, but they're not stupid, and they can spot someone who's patronising them, and they have no time for it, and it does not serve anybody with. Secondly, short-termism. There are no quick fixes here, if you want to get involved, there's no point in volunteering and then 3 months later moving on to something else. Short-termism really doesn't achieve anything. To make a difference requires commitment. The third obstacle today to helping loyalist communities is what referred to earlier on as criminality. And I think that many folks face this dilemma. Okay, I want to help these folks, but I don't want to condone criminality. I don't want to be associated with criminality. And yet, if we have nothing to do with people who have a reputation of, shall we say, bending the rules, then that simply increases their isolation and their sense of paranoia. But if we work with them, we run the risk of appearing to condone their behaviour, and we may also find that our own personal reputations are tarnished by it. But sometimes if you're going to get involved in loyalist communities, it means that you are rubbing shoulders with people who don't do things necessarily strictly by the letter of the law. So how do we approach it? Well, and with this, I draw the conclusion. It's important, I think, when working with with loyalist communities, that we treat everyone with respect and with courtesy. And they've been rubbished more times than we've had hot dinners. But if you don't treat someone with respect, then they're not going to be as what you have to say. Love begets love and respect begets respect. We need to be prepared to listen and not feel that that we know an awful lot more than they do. We need to act in their best interests. We need to deal with people with integrity. We need to be people of our words. Our yes needs to be yes, our no needs to be no. If we say something to this person, we can't go to someone else and say the opposite or something different, because they'll hear what you've said. So we need to be people of our word, and we need to speak clearly. We need to be clear about what we view as acceptable and what's unacceptable. Not to be afraid to challenge things that you believe are wrong. But challenging things is not to judge or condemn, but it is to challenge, and it is to disagree, and it's to look people in the eye and say, I think that was wrong. I think it harms you, it harms your community, and it harms all of us. But you have to win the right to say that. And you have to have won their trust and respect in order to have the opportunity to say it in a way that will achieve anything. We need to show honour where honour is due. I have worked with some men and women that I have the highest respect for. They have sometimes rather spectacular pasts. On some issues I disagree with them strongly, but I have enormous respect for them. I'm not naive enough to think that everybody's either good or bad. I know that people are a mixture. We're all, aren't we, that mixture of good and bad. But I have enormous respect for many of my colleagues and friends in the PUP and in the loyalist communities. I've learned an enormous amount from them and from working with them. I think I'm much a richer person for having done it. But they need people whom they can trust and who will act honourably on their behalf, and who will act in their best interests, and who will not have a personal agenda or not be in it for personal reputation or aggrandisement, but are there genuinely to work with them and to learn from them and to understand their situation and to work with them, enabling them to do what they want to do. Because some of them do have dreams, and some of them do have goals that they want to achieve, and some of them need to be encouraged that they actually can. That that's not unrealistic. You're perfectly capable. That, you know, that was what David Irvine did with and Gusty Spence did with Dawn Purvis. Gusty said to her, "Why don't you go to university?" Dawn said, "I couldn't go to university." He said, "Why? You definitely could go to university." And he encouraged her to go, and she left Queen's with a first class honours in politics. And that's really, you know, what we need to see replicated time and time again. Stephen said at the very start that one of CCCI's roles was to be a presence, and I think that you really cannot underestimate the importance of presence, of just being there, being with them, being in the environment, getting involved in these communities, being a part of it. And I'm a firm believer that presence changes things. You may not be able to write down a list of things that you have achieved over the past 3 years in your involvement with the Lower Shankill Community Association, but your presence will undoubtedly have made things different. And that's, I think, something that I've been utterly convinced of. It's pretty good, because then we can't sort of point at things and say, "I did that," or "I achieved that," because it's much more difficult to actually pin it down. Okay. So with that, maybe I'll stop and invite. I see folks here who have a lot of experience in similar ways.